Good morning, Council. While you're getting settled, I'll just remind you both of what you already know, and that is that you each have 15 minutes for argument. Council for Appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal, should you choose to use it. It's important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent before you begin your argument. And you can raise or lower the podium to suit your needs with the button that's underneath in the middle.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Terrence Travell Hill. Your Honor, in this appeal, Mr. Hill presents three issues. Two of them are sentencing issues that are independent sentencing issues, and the third issue is the revocation of his probation. But before we get into the sentencing issues that I'd like to focus primarily on today, I'd like to address the threshold issue presented in respondent's brief, which asks the question whether these sentencing issues are properly before this court. The sentencing issues are properly before this court. This is a Fields sentencing appeal. Fields held 30 years ago that when a defendant is on probation during a stay of execution, a defendant is not required to challenge his sentence in any way until his probationary sentence is revoked.
But in Fields, if you look at the facts, you would agree that the appellant there did challenge his sentence at the probation revocation hearing. And so, yeah, that was my big question for you. When you look at that Fields and that aspect, and you look at Coles, doesn't that make us have to seriously consider whether this is properly before us?
No.
Why not?
And I would ask this court to rely on Maurstedt, which really does resolve this question.
But Maurstedt's before Coles, right?
Coles does not overturn Maurstedt either in spirit or expressly, and there's a big difference between Coles, Maurstedt, Fields, Losh. Coles is not on probation at the time that he challenged his sentence. Coles' probation was not revoked when he challenged his sentence. The big difference between the Fields and Losh cases versus the Coles, Johnson, Lewis cases where the defendant is challenging the sentence years and years later is that those defendants, they're not under court jurisdiction at the time or any recent time that they're challenging their sentence. But a probationer remains under the jurisdiction of the court continuously until their probation is revoked because the court administers the probationary sentence. The Department of Corrections has exclusive jurisdiction over executed sentences. There's a big difference between a probationer and a person serving an executed sentence.
Well, and I don't think the argument so much, or at least in my mind, is whether your client can challenge this. It's whether your client can challenge sentencing aspects for the first time on appeal on a probation revocation determination. I mean, that seems to be, I mean, Maurstedt, as I looked at least Cole's discussion of Maurstedt was a plea agreement, yes, but it was an agreement that Maurstedt would be sentenced in accordance with his sentencing guidelines. This is a case where there was a specific plea agreement in terms of the top of the box and what the sentence was going to be. And there is an opportunity, it seems to me, for your client to go back to the district court and make this argument in a post-conviction or Rule 27 setting, rather than coming here.
A couple of things, Your Honor, that I disagree with. The sentencing challenge in this case does not implicate the plea agreement in the same way that the sentencing challenge in Coles implicated the plea agreement. So to the extent that respondent asserts that this sentencing challenge should have been raised in a post-conviction petition, that is not what Coles says. It is only when the sentencing challenge implicates the plea agreement in a way that it attacks more than just the sentence, and that's why it wouldn't be appropriate in cases like Coles, not cases like this, but in cases like Coles, to challenge it in a pure Rule 27 motion. And remember, Maurstad says that there's no, that you cannot waive a sentencing challenge. You don't need to, a defendant does not need to preserve a sentencing challenge. And Rule 2703, Subdivision 9, isn't exclusive to district courts. It is to the court. It is to the district court, the Court of Appeals, and to the Supreme Court. So sentencing challenges that are properly before a court of competent jurisdiction do not need to be raised at the district court at the time of the revocation. They do not be need to be raised first in a Rule 27 motion. If this court has jurisdiction over a review of the sentence, as it does in this case, and that arises from a timely appeal from the revocation of its of his probation, which is also a sentencing appeal under Rule 2805, this court has jurisdiction over the sentencing challenge. And to answer your question, Judge Bjorkman, he did not need to raise that sentencing challenge for the first time in the district court. It's not waivable.
Well, but then you're asking us to carve out and look at one aspect of a plea agreement, leaving the rest of the agreement intact. How does that make sense? I mean, a plea agreement depends not just on the sentence imposed, but dismissal of other claims and things. And this was a plea agreement that, as I understand it, not only went to the crimes charged here, but involved an agreement not to charge other crimes.
That's seems not to my understanding of the agreement, Your Honor. My understanding of the agreement is based on page 3 of the police transcripts. As the terms, the express terms of the agreement are presented to the court. The way the terms of the plea agreement as presented to the court is very important because that is what the court relies on in determining whether to do one of two things, and it's only allowed under Rule 15 to do one of two things: accept the plea on its terms, reject the plea on its terms. The district court was presented with the terms of the plea agreement in page 3 of the plea transcripts, and that's the only thing that's presented to this court today. The terms of the agreement are clear. Mr. Hill will receive a stayed sentence, a probationary sentence. The state will dismiss an alternative criminal sexual conduct charge, not a different offense, but an alternative means of committing the same offense, sexual contact with a person under 13 versus sexual penetration. So distinguishing this case from Coles, Coles was the dismissal of a more serious charge with an agreement to an upper durational departure, and Coles reasoned that the state could have gotten or the court could have imposed that sentence had it not dismissed that more serious charge. That's not present here today. The agreement for Mr. Hill and the state, the agreement between the two parties, the express terms as stated on the record, contemplate dismissal of count 2, which he couldn't be convicted of anyway under 6904 because it's a different degree of the same offense, and an agreement that he would receive a stayed sentence, which is a downward dispositional departure. That was the agreement of the parties based on amenability to probation and amenability to treatment. And the other term is that it would be at the top of the box of the sentencing guidelines. They say that they picked the duration because it was the top of the box of the sentencing guidelines based on a criminal history score of 1. So I would challenge the respondent's assertion that the sentencing challenge implicates the plea agreement. I strongly disagree under my reading of the express terms of the agreement as stated in page 3 of the plea transcripts. The agreement.
So the assertion in respondent's brief that part of this was premised on complete dismissal of a separate prosecution for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree against a different victim is inaccurate.
I'm not aware of any other victim. I'm not aware of any other conduct. I've reviewed the complaint in this case, which charges it. I don't see any police incident case report number. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've reviewed this record thoroughly. I'm not aware of this. So no, that's not accurate. I agree that if the conviction in this case, for example, were for third-degree criminal sexual conduct and the sentence was an upper durational departure within the presumptive range. Go ahead, Judge Justin, sorry.
So the part I'm looking at, I believe, because I'm looking at this pretty quickly, just the description of the plea where
line 14 or something like that, yeah.
It says, we had a mistrial declared in this case. Eventually, a plea deal was worked out where the state would dismiss one case in exchange for a guilty in this particular matter.
I'm sorry, one case? Where is that? What line?
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the transcript of the sentencing proceeding.
I
was just trying to
And I have a paper copy of the plea transcripts if it's helpful to the court, and I'd be happy to bring it up. But I will read the terms of the agreement. Our agreement calls for, as part of the agreement, dismissing the file I just referenced. Is that a different case?
Maybe it's
a different case.
Okay.
To the extent that we're looking at the sentence in this case, the sentence is not an upward durational departure, and the sentence is a challenge to the presumptive duration of the guideline sentence. So to the extent, again, to the extent that the sentencing challenge would result in a reduction of the duration of the sentence that the parties anticipated in this case, it is a challenge to the legality of the sentence based on the date of the offense and the calculation of the criminal history score. So again, I don't know what the other charge was off the top of my head. It's a different case file number. It's not currently before this court. But
so if we reach the sentencing issue, would you agree that under Williams, your client has the burden of proof?
No, I would disagree, Your Honor.
Why
Williams
is
a challenge to an out-of-state sentence. Williams is a challenge to a criminal history score imposed for an out-of-state sentence. So what the issue in that case was is attorneys from our office would file a Rule 27 motion challenging the absence of any record of the out-of-state conviction, say that the state has the burden to demonstrate that the out-of-state conviction, A, conforms to a Minnesota offense, and B, was actually a felony sentence, and that it would put the burden on the state to go and, you know, where they didn't go get the records at the original sentencing, it would make the state go and get the records from Illinois, where they really don't like to give records over there. It's very difficult, which might explain why they didn't have the records in the first place. But Williams says that if a defendant is going to challenge his sentence later on in a Rule 27 motion, then the defendant needs to go get those records instead of making the state go and get those records. So Williams is distinguishable because it's an out-of-state conviction.
So the burden of proof is on the state, even if it's an issue you're arguing is error.
It's an immaterial in this case. Who has the burden, because it's a matter of public record in the district court file. Williams is only an issue because it's a question of which party needed to go to Illinois and get those records that are very hard to obtain to demonstrate that the out-of-state conviction, that the out-of-state conviction wouldn't conform to either a Minnesota offense.
And it doesn't seem that clear to me, though, counsel, which is why I was asking about the burden of proof, because if your client stipulated the offense occurred, and correct me where I'm wrong here on the record, occurred after August 2006, and we know the time frame is 2006 to 2008, and the one custody point that we're talking about related to 2007 offense, it doesn't seem crystal clear to me in the record that there was a sentencing error, which kind of gets to my question about the burden of proof.
I think that, Your Honor, we've met that burden of proof by citing to the district court file number where probation was imposed. This court can look at the public record that I've cited to in my brief and ascertain that the sentence was imposed in the summer of 2007 in that subsequent drug case, and that the fall of 2006 encompasses a date range that you can go by an astronomical calendar, a Gregorian calendar, whatever you want. But we know that fall of 2006 doesn't go past December 31st, 2006, and
I thought the stipulation, so I just want to make sure I understand, was that the offense occurred after August 1, 2006. So I just want to make sure I understand your position on this. Your position was it occurred.
I'm quoting from the transcript, page 3 of the sentencing transcript dated August 28, 2013. And this is the court speaking. It is my understanding, Ms. Lightbody, that for the purposes of this plea and the sentencing, Mr. Hill stipulates that the offense occurred in the fall of 2006, therefore, after August 1st, 2006. Is that correct? And they go back and forth a little bit. Yes, it's the fall of 2006. That's the parameter. If it was after fall of 2006 and they didn't stipulate that it was in the fall of 2006, I agree that it would be less clear that after fall of 2006 would encompass a date range that went from September 1st, 2006 until the last charging date. But because it expressly says at the sentencing what Mr. Hill is stipulating to, albeit improperly and in violation of his Blakely rights under DeRozier, they're agreeing that the date range for the offense is sometime after August 1st, 2006, but not into beyond January 1st, 2007.
But I'm looking at the district court actually questioning your client about the date. It occurred sometime in the fall, and your client said, yes, ma'am, and the district court said, and it was after August 1st, 2006, yes, and it could have been either the fall of 2006, 2007, or 2008. Is that correct? Your client said yes.
I think it's an accurate reading of the transcripts, but it needs to be read in the context of why the court is asking that question, and it's the court's announcements and defense counsel's agreement that the defendant would be stipulating to the date of the offense as occurring sometime in the fall of 2006. So I ask that
the statements do go on, counsel. I mean, at the bottom of the same page that Judge Bjorkman was just reading. So, and my page numbers are not printed clearly, but it is the defendant's response. First, the court's question, and you don't know, and DS doesn't know with specificity the date of the alleged offense. It would have been either in the fall of 2006, 2007, or 2008. Is that correct? Yes, ma'am, says the defendant.
Your Honor, I think
Again, it does seem to be important who has the burden of proof.
As to the,
I mean, that was Judge Justin's initial question.
Well, the burden
of the record is unclear.
The burden of proof in Williams is proving the when the probation was, not when the date of offense is in this case. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury what the date of the offense was. The defendant has the burden of proof of proving the other conviction that the criminal, that the custody status point would arise from. I see I'm out of time.
You will have time for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I'm here representing the respondent, which is the state of Minnesota, in this matter. Before I start my argument on the issues, I have a real need to clarify the facts of this plea agreement because I believe they were misstated by appellant during his argument. The state of Minnesota, when they came to the agreement with the defendant for this sentence for 187 months, they gave up things in exchange for that. We dismissed a completely separate prosecution for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. And I cited to the court file number of that on page 4 in my brief. That is a matter of public record. That wasn't just an alternative count on the complaint to which he pled to. That was a completely separate prosecution, separate named victim in that complaint with a 2010-2012 offense date. So I want to make that very clear. It was not the same offense, a different count, or a different type of sexual conduct. It was a completely different case that we could have gone to trial on. And had he been convicted on both, he would have been at a score of 3 by the time he was sentenced on that case. So we gave up that second case because he agreed to 187 months. We also gave up or withdrew the Blakely motion, in which we were going to actually seek an upward departure outside of the box. And we also agreed to a dispositional departure.
What difference does this make to the question of whether the sentencing issue was properly before this court?
I just needed to clarify that because I think those facts are really misstated. And just for reference, that it's very clear in the petition to enter a guilty plea, and it's also very clear in the plea transcript that other court files reference. So I just wanted to clarify that. And as to the issue whether it should be before you, it shouldn't. Under the guise of a probation revocation appeal, what Mr. Hill is doing after he failed probation, after he was given a chance, failed probation 3 times and was finally revoked, now he wants to come back and completely dismantle this plea agreement. But all he wants to change is the amount of time he agreed to. He wants to keep all the other benefits of the agreement. Procedurally, the problem with that, the reason it's not properly before the court is it was never addressed in district court. This attack on the plea agreement has never been addressed in district court. It was not raised at the sentencing, of course, because he wanted the agreement at that time because it was beneficial to him. It was not addressed at the revocation hearing like it was in Fields. It was never addressed in a 2703 motion, in a post-conviction petition, or at any other time. So the state, at no time since 2013, have we had the chance in district court to address all of these issues that you're hearing about for the first time. Criminal history score, what version of the guidelines should have applied. We didn't get to litigate any of those issues in district court because they were never raised. So our position, number one position, is this is not properly before you for that reason. Now, the only...
Just so I understand, counsel, you're saying that the appellant should have raised the criminal history score error in a post-conviction proceeding? And you, which case do you rely on for that? If I understand you right.
False.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Okay. False. You know, I'll start with Fields. So the authority...
No, I follow you in terms of the difference
the
with Fields.
The authority for raising this on a probation revocation appeal is this Fields case. But Fields is 31 years old, and I appreciate that this court can't overrule Fields, but you can distinguish it. And it's distinguishable for a lot of reasons. Number one, Fields was not a plea agreement. Fields was not a plea agreement. The court imposed, this was way before Blakely when courts could do upward departures on their own findings. The court imposed this upward departure. Obviously, the defendant did not agree to it. That was not a plea agreement. And he did wait until his revocation hearing, and then he properly challenged it at that revocation hearing.
So you're not asking us to say that it had to be in a post-conviction petition?
I am.
Why couldn't he have, why isn't it a fair reading of Coles with Fields to say, or post-conviction, or as at the probation revocation hearing? The point being, you would at least have the opportunity to respond at the district court level.
An opportunity to respond is key. But the point of Fields, the other reason why Fields is distinguishable is because the whole premise of Fields is it's all based on 2703. And it's based on the idea under Rule 2703, you can challenge an illegal sentence at any time. So that's why Fields said he did challenge it. He challenged it at the revocation. You can challenge it at any time. And then he brought a timely appeal. That's what Fields was based on. And frankly, Mauerstadt.
Wasn't Fields really based on more than that, but just we don't want to have, you know, unnecessary? That was a policy issue that the court was relying upon.
They said it'll create fewer sentencing appeals if people can wait. Great for this court, not necessarily great for the criminal justice system if we're having these agreements challenged.
But we are bound by Fields, and that was their predominant.
Correct. Correct. And the reason why Fields and Mauerstadt don't apply to this is because 2703 doesn't apply to this. This request, this remedy that he's asking for, this complete gutting of the plea agreement, goes far beyond what 2703 provides for. This is talked about, it started being talked about in Lewis in 2003, and then Coles, I think, really laid it out. When the actual sentence number is so interrelated to the plea agreement, that is not 2703. That must be brought in a post-conviction motion. And the problem with that is, and that would be appellant's problem, if the time is run for a post-conviction motion, he is going to have to convince the district court that an exception applies. And we have that time limit on post-convictions because we want that finality. We want that finality. It was decided long ago. We are going to put a statute of limitations on the post-conviction petition. So if his response is, well, I can't do a post-conviction petition because it's not timely, so be it. But that is how this attack has to be brought. And the court specifically in Coles stated, where the sentence at issue is imposed as part of a plea agreement, a motion to change that sentence impacts more than simply the sentence, and Rule 2703 doesn't apply. It goes on to talk about the conviction component and the sentence component being interrelated, and then states if the defendant succeeds in reducing his or her sentence, he or she retains the benefit of the reduced criminal charge, in this case, a completely dismissed criminal charge, but the state no longer receives the benefit of the longer sentence. And that's exactly what Mr. Hill is trying to do in this case. As an illustration, had we not agreed to dismiss that other case, had we decided we were going to put that victim through a second trial after the hung jury on the case he pled on, we could have tried that first case. Had he been convicted, he would have had two more criminal history points. Had we tried the second case and he was convicted, the sentencing range he would have been looking at that point would be 153 to 216 months with a presumptive sentence of 180 months. When he agreed to 187 months, that got us to the sentence that we would get. Had we gone forward on both of those cases, we didn't have to put a victim through a trial again. So there's a lot that goes into a plea agreement, and to just simply take the number and reduce it 6 years later and let him keep the benefit of everything else That's just, it's not right. It's not right. He needs to raise that in a post-conviction challenge. The state needs the opportunity at that point, if the court accepts it and finds that it's timely or meets some exception, then we can litigate SCORE. Then we can litigate what guidelines apply. Then we can say, you know what, Judge, we want out. We want out of this plea agreement. We're going to set both cases on for trial, and we should have the right to do that. And we can't do that when he's just raising it here. I can go, if you have any other questions on the procedural posture of it being here or why it shouldn't be here, I can cover that. Otherwise, if you're going to consider the issues here on appeal, I can talk a little bit about the merits of the criminal history score, if there's no more questions.
Would you address the burden of proof issue that we discussed with counsel for appellant?
My understanding is whether it's out of, that the burden of proof is on the defendant. That, I mean, that's my read of the law. I don't see the distinction that he mentioned if it's only out-of-state convictions. It was my understanding. We have the burden of proof to prove criminal history score at sentencing.
Well, this was the facts in Williams, correct? Wasn't it? Weren't?
I don't have Williams right in front of me, so I'm not going to disagree with that. I can't agree or disagree. But my understanding is at this point the defendant or the appellant has the burden of proof. And I don't have a case to cite for you to cover that. I'm sorry. So the merits of the criminal history score issue, I think the criminal history score is correct. At least appellant hasn't shown that it's not. The record establishes clearly that this was an agreement based on a mutual belief and understanding that he had a criminal history score of 1, and the guidelines everybody was using were the 2006 guidelines. The record's really clear that that was everybody's understanding. At sentencing, you can tell from the record, if you look at the transcript, this issue came up in the pre-sentence investigation. Oops, the very beginning of the offense date range goes under some old guidelines, and that needed to be fixed before the district court could go forward. That's when that interaction between the court, the defense attorney, and appellant occurred, where they essentially supplemented the factual basis as far as offense date by clarifying that it was after August 1st of 2006.
And that's clarifying an element of the offense.
It's an element of the offense. I mean, he already admitted when he did his initial plea, they did it by the range that's stated in the complaint, 2006 to 2008. So it needed to be narrowed in order to stay in the guidelines that everybody was trying to operate under. So that factual basis was supplemented at that sentencing hearing. My problem with appellant's argument about criminal history scores, I think he's taking that conversation out of context. That conversation was had specifically to clarify that sentencing guidelines issue. It was not meant to mean this offense only occurred in the fall of 2006. That's not what that was about. It was just making sure we are all operating under the correct guidelines. So I don't believe that that record that was made on that can be taken to mean the offense only occurred in the fall of 2006, therefore there can't be a custody point. I don't think it's that clear. I think it's being taken out of context.
If I can turn your attention to the Blakely issue.
Sure.
If we reach that issue, wouldn't you agree that because there was no waiver of the jury rights, we have to find that error, and then the question is whether it's harmless?
I don't agree that there was an error. I don't think it's a Blakely issue at all.
Well, I mean, he didn't waive his jury rights, right? So why wouldn't it be an issue?
The difference between DeRozier, he didn't plead. He said, I want a jury to decide the offense date. I'm going to trial on all the elements. The jury's going to decide all of the elements, including offense date. And then the judge went further on his own and made more specific findings on the offense date. That's where the Blakely violation occurred. In this case, the defendant waived, when he pled guilty, he waived his right to have the jury determine all the elements of the offense. And the offense date is one of the elements of the offense that he waived the right to have a jury determine. So he pled guilty to that date. And then it was clarified again at the sentencing hearing. There was never any request by him to have a jury determine that date.
Well, nobody can consider this plea to be to an aggravated sentence.
Correct.
I mean, so Blakely wasn't in anybody's mind.
No, not at all. And again, the offense date which is, you know, what the court has defined that he's admitted to every one of the elements. The offense date is one of them. There wouldn't be any reason to have a separate jury determine it when it's already an element that he pled to. Now, the appellant cites to Detman and says, well, you can't make a finding off of the defendant's or the appellant's factual basis. Detman's completely different because they took findings that weren't elements. I believe in Detman it was like particular cruelty to the victim or vulnerability to the victim or one of those aggravating factors that's not an element of the offense. And the court pulled it out of the factual basis. In this case, the factual basis was the elements, and that's what the sentence was based on. So I don't believe there is a Blakely issue implicated at all in this case.
If I could, in light of the time remaining, ask about the Austin findings.
Not great.
I mean, there's no reference I see to the second Austin factor, nothing about intent or excuse.
So how never said the word intentional or inexcusable.
Can you point us to any case that would say this was acceptable?
Nope, there's not. I think the other Austin factors have been satisfied. I think the violations were clearly stated on the record. I think at the end he talked about, you know, weighing the needs of the community and safety and why he needed to be incarcerated rather than on probation. I think he covered 1 and 3. 2, he didn't mention.
So don't we have to then reverse and remand on
you
that?
Can reverse and have the district court has to make findings. I mean, it doesn't undo the violation. I would ask that just like in Motland and most of the other cases, it's reversed just for the findings. No, Judge Baxter's retired. But, I mean, it would be reassigned to another judge and it can be reversed for the appropriate findings. My only argument on the intentional and inexcusable portion, and there's no case law to support this really, but it's kind of implied in the nature of the violations and what he admitted that it couldn't have been accidental or excusable. So, I mean, it's implied by the nature of the violations, but if this court strictly says the courts must utter the words intentional and inexcusable, Judge Baxter didn't. And I've got nothing more to say on that.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Withall, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I dispute. Oh, sorry. Can I get 5 minutes on the clock, please? Your Honor, I dispute that the date of the offense is an element of the offense. I would draw this court's attention to Minnesota Statute 625.18. That statute tells the state how to charge out offenses, and that statute says that the state does not actually even need to allege an offense date, and you see that reflected in the way the state charged out this case, alleging vaguely and generally that the offense took place sometime over the course of a 3-year term, a single act over the course of a 3-year term. And 628.15 acknowledges that an offense could include in the elements, because it says, unless otherwise stated as an element to the offense in the statute defining what the offense is. But the offense date is not presumptively and automatically a date of the offense, and it's very relevant because of the state's argument. Usually it doesn't come up. The date of the offense is usually relevant for sentencing, for statute of limitation purposes, for determining which version of the guidelines is applicable in a case or whether this offense predated the enactment of a crime, but it is not a statutory element defining an actus reus or a mens rea traditionally reserved to an element of the offense actually is.
But it was a factual stipulation that was part of the plea agreement, correct?
The date of the offense in this case was not part of the plea agreement.
Well, I'm looking at the plea petition, and it said, I've been charged with this, committed on or about January 1st, 2006 to December 31st, 2008.
But the
and the admission was to that charge, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. As part of the plea, or as part of Mr. Hill's admission to the crime, he acknowledged that the date took place within a 3-year term. But that's, again, not an element of the offense. That's relevant here because it is a sentencing element as it is applied to the issues presented before this court. And it's relevant because he did not waive the determination under DeRozier of the offense date as part of his waiver of his right to a jury trial on the issue of guilt. Detman and DeRozier and all of those cases, 2005, 2006, following Blakely, identified that there is a right to a separate jury sentencing trial under the United States and Minnesota constitutions, that you have a right to a jury trial both on the issue of guilt and a separate issue on sentencing questions, aggravating factors, offense date, more recently whether or not you're a level three predatory offender at the time of the offense for failure to register, all sorts of implications, but it is not an element of the offense in any of those contexts, and it's very important to distinguish that in this case because we're talking about a separate constitutional jury trial right.
But he had waived his right. I mean, they agreed to the sentence, so I'm trying to understand what there was for the district court to decide. He wasn't disputing the sentence. He had agreed to it.
DeRozier's a 2006 case. This sentencing and plea was in 2013. All the parties should have been aware of the law at the time that it is a jury question as to whether what the offense date was for the purposes of determining what applicable guidelines or what version of the guidelines apply to the.
And you're saying case. A defendant can't waive that?
The defendant can waive that, but it means to be a knowing,
separate,
voluntary, intelligent waiver of the right to a separate jury trial. And the state also asserts that that Mr. Hill, because he did not assert that he wanted a jury trial, somehow waived it. It's quite the opposite, Your Honor. A defendant needs to affirmatively enter a valid waiver of a fundamental constitutional right. He does not need to assert it in order to have that right. He has that right unless he waives it. And that's, I think, a misstatement of the law. Speaking of misstatements, I acknowledge that I failed to identify an alternative charge with a different victim, a different fact scenario, completely unrelated to this one. Dismissed as part of the plea agreement, but again, this is an agreement to a guideline sentence, and this challenge to the sentence under determining what the presumptive guideline sentence is and the Blakely issue, those don't implicate the plea agreement to the extent that the state dismissed a more serious charge in exchange for an upward durational departure like you see in Coles. This is factually distinct from Coles in that regard. Unless the court has any additional questions, I would ask this court to one last point. If this court reverses on the probation issue, we ask that it be reversed all the way to the beginning. Because the district court judge has since retired, the court would be relying exclusively on the transcripts, and this court could just do a review of the transcripts and determine whether it was intentional and excusable, and that's contrary to the law. So the district court wouldn't be in a different position than this court in reviewing the existing record. The district court reviewing should review this de novo, should determine whether or not there's a violation, determine whether the violations are inexcusable and whether the needs for confinement. It's just not possible to vindicate that.
If I may. Yes. So I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So you want us to direct the district court not just to go back and look at, let's say, the second Oxton factor, but to hold another contested probation revocation hearing. Is that your...
Yes, Your Honor, or waive the contested hearing. And otherwise, it's just a magic words test. A district court could look at this and go, intentional and excusable, and we're done here. This court's in that position. This court can look in the record and make that determination. But Austin and Motlin make it very clear that that's not this court's role. And that's because of the difference between the district court judge sitting right in front of the witness and the defendant, ascertaining the credibility and the weight of the testimony in light of all the evidence presented in front of it. And if you remand it just on the second factor, the district court's just going to say the magic words or not, and it's just not fair. Nothing else.
All right.
The court has further questions.
I don't believe that we do. Thank you both for your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.